KUT 90.3 FM Montreal. Montreal, a city that I love, 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 love.
You're knocking on the right door. If you're looking for something, well, refreshing, you're tuned in to the right station. You're listening to the coolest station in Montreal, 90.3 FM on your dial. The alternative station, the one that gives you a choice and a voice. CKUT. Stay tuned.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
The spread of the COVID-19 virus and its variants has become critical. For everyone's well-being, contact must be kept to a minimum, and health measures must continue, including washing your hands, keeping your distance, and wearing a mask. If you have symptoms, get tested and self-isolate at home. This effort is essential. For more information, visit quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Hello, and welcome to Signs of the Times on CKUT, a show trying to understand the uncharted cultural waters that we find ourselves in today. A little later in the show today, we'll be interviewing Marlene Hale of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. But before that, Elle and I are going to provide a little context. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Olive.
And my name is Elle. Today, we'll be talking about Wet'suwet'en and the pipeline expansion project that they are opposing. So Wet'suwet'en is in so-called BC, in North Inland.
So the pipeline project that's going through is being built by CGL. So the pipeline is planning to go from Edmonton, Alberta, all the way through the Rockies into Burnaby, BC. And the pipeline is planned to go through the traditional territory of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. This project was bought by the Canadian federal government for $4.5 billion. The original budget was supposed to be $7.6 billion, but actually in 2020, the budget was upped to $12.6 billion. This is just the cost of construction. It does not cover the massive police presence that has accrued around the pipeline, disrupting attempts to defend the land from the Canadian government.
So some context on Wet'suwet'en, just to give you some background before you listen. So Wet'suwet'en Nation, it's made up of clans, one of them being Gidimdan, which is one of the main checkpoints of opposition to this pipeline. Under the clans, there's also houses. And in each house, there's a hereditary chief. So hereditary chiefs are based in traditional Wet'suwet'en law. They are different from the band councils. So the band councils are colonially imposed. They were imposed by the Indian Act of 1876. The Indian Act is also what created reservations. So the band council has approved this pipeline, but as I said, they are a colonially imposed government, and they don't have any authority or jurisdiction outside of reservation land. And reservations don't necessarily equate to traditional territory. So ultimately, the hereditary chiefs who govern the traditional territory since time immemorial under Wet'suwet'en law have the ultimate jurisdiction over what happens on Wet'suwet'en land. And the hereditary chiefs under traditional law are opposing the pipeline expansion in Wet'suwet'en.
So the hereditary chiefs oppose the construction of this pipeline because it's going to do massive damage to the land. They have not consented to the construction of the project, and it's going to go right through the sacred headwaters of their land. So the traditional headwaters of the nation is known as Wedzinqua. It is the only remaining source of clean water left on the nation. All the other sources have been polluted by colonial projects. And Coastal GasLink is about to drill right beneath the sacred headwaters. This directly threatens the existence and survival of all the Wet'suwet'en people. It's a central location for salmon migration. It's one of the major traditional food sources for the region. And this pipeline would totally disrupt and destroy that vital part of the ecosystem. Additionally, the construction of the pipeline relies on what are called man camps. Basically, temporary housing and everything for the workers that are living on site. These man camps have been one of the primary factors driving missing and murdered Indigenous women. There's very little oversight for what goes on in these camps, and the workers are often very hostile to the people of the land.
So just for a brief historical context for this opposition is the Delgamuukw case of 1997, which was a ruling that declared Indigenous rights to unceded territory, and this includes the Wet'suwet'en Nation territory. Under this ruling, it also is important to note the role of free, prior, and informed consent. So Canada as a settler nation has not received free, prior, and informed consent from the Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs. And the UN actually made a declaration under UNDRIP, which is the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, saying and declaring and demanding that Canada puts a halt on this pipeline until they've received free, prior, and informed consent from the hereditary chiefs. So first, free, prior, and informed consent is restorative. So that means that it centers Indigenous models of government, including the hereditary council and the hereditary chiefs under traditional law. It's also epistemic, meaning that it includes Indigenous knowledge systems on relationality and relationships to land and other than human kin. It's also reciprocal. So this ensures that the ones being asked for consent, in this case, the Wet'suwet'en Nation, are the ones who are also defining what consent means in their own terms. And lastly, it's legitimate. So that means that this consent is officiated by legitimate members of community who can have a say on this matter. So therefore being, in this case, the hereditary chiefs.
Until free, prior, and informed consent is given by the hereditary chiefs, this project is illegitimate, immoral, and genocidal in nature. It displaces the Indigenous peoples from their land and threatens ways of life that have gone back to time immemorial. Our interview with Marlene Hale was recorded on November 25th. So the events leading up to that were as follows. On Saturday, November 13th, torrential downpours began in BC, leading to a lot of the flooding that we have heard so much about and is continuing as of right now. This is clearly a climate change caused event.
It's also very obvious that the flooding in BC is directly related to what happened in Lytton and other parts of BC this summer with the forest fires and how the land has been left vulnerable to not being able to absorb as much water, not having enough topsoil, etc. and so forth. So you can really see the connections between different climate change caused natural disasters.
So climate change obviously is playing a big role in what is going on in BC right now, but I think it's also important to recognize the interconnection between colonialism and climate change. The colonial extractivist mindset is what has caused us to end up in this situation of climate change in the first place. And the expansion of the pipeline is just one further expression of that colonial project. If we want to stop climate change, we also have to address issues of colonialism and vice versa. On November 19th, there was an RCMP raid on Wet'suwet'en land. After land defenders enforced a eviction notice that they had served back in 2018, basically stating that until free, prior, and informed consent was given, that all construction on the pipeline had to stop, people had to leave the territory, and they shut down one of the main roads into the nation. So the raid was undertaken by the Community Industry Response Group, which is a branch of the BC RCMP, which answers directly to the oil companies and other corporate interests in the region, specifically energy interests. And I think it helps demonstrate how the corporate state looks after the interests of corporate power before the needs of anybody else, the people, especially the Indigenous peoples of this land. The RCMP response was vastly disproportional. So in the midst of all this flooding, the RCMP deployed a huge amount of heavily militarized police. We're talking automatic rifles. We're talking like snipers being deployed all over. The land defenders that they came to arrest illegally were unarmed. They broke into the territory, broke down the door of one of the cabins in Gedemden checkpoint, and arrested 15 people there. I think in total 30 people were arrested, and many of them were not actively participating in the blockade. They just happened to be around. Media was arrested as well, which kind of illegal. Furthermore, they bulldozed the entire Gedemden checkpoint that was established to prevent TMX from encroaching on the land more. Houses that were there were burned to the ground. There hasn't been an explanation for this, but it is likely retaliation for defending the land. And the conditions for release of arrest from all the people that were arrested were determined by CGL directly. They wanted to ban all arrested land defenders from entering the territory at all, which is a violation of their Section 35 rights of the Constitution of Rights and Freedoms, and a clear violation of Wet'suwet'en law. So people that have been barred from the territory, so land defenders, if they have access to the space at all, are only allowed to come and go from their homes. They can't fish. They can't interact with the land in any way. This is clearly to stop them from continuing to defend the land, but it is completely immoral and, once again, a violation of Wet'suwet'en law.
So opposition has been happening since 2010 to this pipeline and other extraction projects. But even before then, traditional law and traditional territory directly opposes Canadian extractivism of any form. So the most recent raid was just one of many raids that has happened since 2010. And Marlene Hale, who you'll be hearing from next, mentions the February 2019 raid that kind of set off her solidarity action within here in Montreal.
So this interview was recorded on November 25th.
Good morning. I am Marlene Hale, and I'm from the Wet'suwet'en Nation, and I'm from the Luxilio clan, which means small frog. My mother, her name was Guhe, and she was a chief of the Wet'suwet'en Nation and I want to thank you both, Elise and Olive, for inviting me to your program, Signs of the Times.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on the show.
So, Marlene, could you tell us a little bit about what's happening in Wet'suwet'en right now?
Well, Elise, from the last word that I've been reaching out, that I speak to them up there, my family, my sister Charlotte Yeverman, almost on a daily basis. It's usually from my brother Lawrence Basil, who was one of the elders who got arrested up there before the total, I think, was being over 30 arrested. Him and his wife were arrested. They were taken by ambulance to the hospital because they were in need of their medication, her especially, because she had heart issues. They are all fine, and it was a really very difficult for us through the weekend to seeing of when they are going to be released, all of them. And Molly, of course, Wickham was one of the last ones to be let out and put into court. The process of the court just took way, way too long, considering what it was. But then again, where they were in the small towns between Prince George all the way up to Houston and Smithers, the courthouses are very small.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Would you mind explaining some of the context around this recent raid, the activities that have been going on in the nation?
Well, let's go right back to when the Molly and the Chief Wass, our hereditary chief, had put a he spoke out and mentioned that the roads were going to be closed. They had ample enough time to have everybody from the camps to get out. Right from that, when they had announced that, the CGL did not do the right thing of getting in touch with all the supervisors, superintendents, everything up at the camp. I'm sure it could not be just miscommunicated. They clearly did not care to have the people out and then cry out that they were having a shortage of food and water and for that many people. And so there, that was just done without due care and attention to be attentive, to allow everybody. Some people left apparently on their own, and that's how we know that when they came out, they had spoken out and said that they were not told about what was going to happen in the next few days. They were not told about the road closure at all.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. And for the folks that are listening who might not know exactly what's happening in Wet'suwet'en since 2010, when the Unist'ot'en camp was first put in place and CGL, which is the pipeline company, put an injunction in place. Could you explain a little bit about the history, maybe from 2010 or even earlier?
I will start going back to, absolutely, Elisa, I'm going to start going back to January the 8th of 2019, when the Coastal GasLink put an injunction on the Unist'ot'en and Wet'suwet'en nations to put a 470-kilometer pipeline through the 22,000 square kilometers of the Wet'suwet'en nation. When that happened, it was just angered and put such a division within our people, because of course there are some that who did sign the agreement that they could go through the band council. Let's go through that. And when that happened, it just angered so many people to the core, where when I was speaking in Montreal here, I'd spoken to all the media, and when on that day, one of the media, I think it was APTN, who had asked me, if Prime Minister Trudeau was here, what would you say to him today? And my message to Prime Minister Trudeau that day was to say, letting him know that he had clearly sold us out, and I was right from the start. January the 14th of that, still about a few weeks later, he was in St. Hyacinthe, Quebec, at a town hall meeting, and I was there, and I was one of the last two people to be selected to ask him. So lo and behold, he did not succeed. Almost the last person that he was to allowed to ask him anything. And I stood up, and when I said, my name is Marlene Hale, and I'm from the Wet'suwet'en Nation, the whole place felt dead silent. And some of the questions that I asked him today is something I will still ask him again today. That day, the first one was, Mr. Prime Minister, that he had just totally led us, in the wrong path of his, by not speaking out to us or with us. And the first question that I asked was him was on respect, Wagoos in our language, that it was just totally not respected at all, the respect to the Indigenous people and to the Wet'suwet'en Nation. The other one, the next question was on the consent, whether he got it right or wrong on what the consent is between the Band Council, which is just all to do with administration of the office in the communities, and it had nothing to do with the land title holders, which is the hereditary chiefs. And he did not ask, so that the consent was it should not have been even without a question to me, saying that it was never given consent, because you asked, of course, the wrong people. And the other question that I had on him was about truth and reconciliation. Where was that with standing with him and Indigenous people? This is not what we call truth and reconciliation. The last question I asked him, Mr. Prime Minister, who gave the order to the RCMP? The order has to come from the top. And he was very respectful and, of course, dancing around all the questions to me, but respectful in a sense where in the audience was a lot of yellow vests, and they were really heckling a lot of people that were getting up and speaking. And he stopped me for a second and just turned to them and said that I was a Wet'suwet'en elder and to be respectful to me, and which they were. And so given that, it totally escalated into when they went in to get him down the first time and they arrested the 14 people. For the 14 people they had up there, I remember getting that phone call that day from my sister saying that she lives across in Smithers, BC from a big hotel, one of the biggest in Smithers called the Hudson Bay Lodge. And she was so upset because from her kitchen window, she can clearly see a huge bus and about 20 vehicles behind it. And she said they were just now loading up with RCMP with tactical guns, rifles. And she was in tears. And at that time, she'd said, Marlene, you've got to help us. You got to get this word out to the world. And that's exactly what we had done. We were calling us on this on nationwide, Canada-wide, and then we went worldwide. And that's exactly what it was. And when they went up later and they went into Unistoten, and in the middle of a ceremony, which they were doing for the missing and murdered Indigenous women, Frieda Hewson and the matriarchs up there were just drumming and singing, and it was to bring our women home so that their spirits will be back onto the territory. And right in the middle of ceremony, it was the images that the world could not stand was when the RCMP were mishandling the drums of the matriarchs, and how one RCMP jeered around a big smile around the red dresses, and that was what shut Canada down. And so we know from then what had happened Canada-wide. And it really started a ripple of solidarity so strongly. And that was when the time it was on our side at that time, we had the mainstream media with us, which is a very different story as of today.
Yeah. I just wanted to touch for a moment on truth and reconciliation, because there has been a lot of talk recently, especially from the government, about truth and reconciliation, but the actions of the government do not match up with what they're claiming to be pursuing, right? Especially with this most recent militarized attack on the nation. The level of deployment in terms of like military personnel from the state is completely disproportionate and extremely violent and wrong.
And there's even, you know, debate between what is truth and reconciliation, who is it for, and how is it different from decolonization, and like how is it different from shut down Canada? So if you could touch a little bit about what is Shut Down Canada, the impact of solidarity action connected to decolonization, and maybe your thoughts on truth and reconciliation, that'd be great.
Oh, that would be my pleasure. So Elise and Olive, so where I was just finishing off where Canada shut down, and they shut down all the railways, the highways. The most important thing that was costing billions of dollars to the economy in Canada, it really clearly sent out a message that not only just the Indigenous people worldwide have just been have just had it, where it comes to down to the number one, the Indigenous issues, which leads us into when Prime Minister Trudeau this last election called the election, and two of the biggest things that he had on there was truth and reconciliation was number one. And we saw that, and other issues with Indigenous, well, nothing transpired on that election at all. And so anyways, we get it, that he is just not withholding up his job, and his word really these days really doesn't mean anything to us on any speeches that he gave, including the throne speech just recently. So when you're talking about when Canada shut down, the solidarity came so thick and hard all across the nation, worldwide, and the United States, and we were getting and still are getting many messages all from all over the world once again, because certain other countries and back in that September of that year, I flew to Panama City and I was talking to 23 different countries on this issue alone of the extractions and everything else placed upon Indigenous people worldwide, not just in Wet'suwet'en Nation. And whereas worldwide, all the Latin American countries, and they still are today, the activists there, they get just for getting out and speaking out on the industry and what the government are doing, and they get killed. Whereas here, we it's not gotten that drastic. But we are still holding each other in solidarity, knowing that we are what we are facing worldwide, and where how it's going so horribly now. And like right now, you have two issues here: truth and reconciliation with the Indigenous people. They have right there. It's not the truth when you are not listening to the leaders. It is not truth, and when you have no respect for the leaders. And the respect there is just nowhere when you are just allowing industry to make their own decisions of bringing the RCMP in, and then later just billing the government, which has been over $6 million now between the Wet'suwet'en and Fairy Creek and beyond. That is a lot of money. And it's monies that could go right now, and instead of going on to another topic of what is all the floods and everything else that has gone through this horrible times that we're going through, is where they should be deploying these RCMP, doing some real work for a change, instead of just, beating down on people and on Indigenous. And we went through that in Fairy Creek, where I have witnessed, and I will not have Indigenous youth come up to the front lines, simply because they singled them out, and I was there when they with students talking and crying and so upset, talking, saying that, if you're Indigenous, you stand over here. If you're the media, you stand over here. And they would ask why. Well, because you'll be the first to be arrested. And they were arrested viciously. I have got so many, about 270 stories of how viciously they have been arrested. And the same group have gone from Wet'suwet'en Nation to Fairy Creek on Vancouver Island, back up to Wet'suwet'en Nation again. They are the same ones. So there was two plane load of them, plus bus loads of going into the territory, plus a lot of cars. And it was witnessed again, paraded through town, the town of Smithers and the town of Houston, where the locals are just, getting so fed up with this and tired of just, all of the stories that they visibly see up there. And they have put hardships on not only just up in the territories, but into the small towns as well, because they've taken over all the hotels, the restaurants, and it's really caused hardships and more division amongst the people. So that makes it harder for each and every one of us to do, just to be there and be visible, to enjoy life. So therefore, that we went with truth and reconciliation to decolonizing. And the decolonizing is the most important thing that we have been working on from since time immemorial. When you talk about the Wet'suwet'en Nation, and going back to, I was just talking about this on a story yesterday, whereas our ancestors, my parents, my grandparents, and many before them have traveled through the 22,000 of square kilometers, not by truck or by car, by foot, by horse and buggy. At that time, I can remember stories from my parents when the first time they were set out and they were on the trap lines of where it is now today, all been destroyed by CGL. If it takes us today an hour to travel from Houston, BC to Smithers to get our shopping, it would take them by horse and buggy a week and their time. And they never bought anything at the store, such as meat, vegetables, fruit. They lived off of the land. It was what they hunted, what they trapped, and what they caught, berries, our teas, and our wild game, our fish. The fish stock was just amazing at that time. And now, dwindling to now what it is today. So when you see and what it was in the past and for how many hundreds of years that it has been respected, and we do then the colonizers came in and tried to put, you know, taking the children away, putting our parents into the residential school system, and it led from the hardships of the time that they were. My mother was 6 years old when she went to Lee Jack School in Fraser Lake, BC. And she would speak about the aunts and uncles that we had that were there and how long they were all there and when they got out. And even today with our Wet'suwet'en language, it is being revised. It's and also, we have a history book, and the history book shows back how the elders and what they had to say was what comprised of our history of the Wet'suwet'en Nation and what it is today. With the colonization and trying to take all of the colonizers out of the picture and just go back to that time when it was trapping and you know, the beautiful life that was there before what it is now today. We always say that our elders are looking down at us and they're praying and they're very worried about us because of what we are now going through, but what our future is going to be like. Very grim.
Yeah.
And the survival is just basically what we all have left, just to survive as a nation.
I think just in terms of that, like, especially the situation in BC right now with the flooding caused by climate change, it makes it mm-hmm. even more kind of unfathomable and just disgusting the opportunism that the RCMP and CGL is taking with all the chaos from the floods, using this as the moment to try to push through and enforce the interests of CGL in Ferry Creek, trying to open up new logging roads into the heart of the territory. Mm-hmm. I think I also just wanted to say, in terms of truth and reconciliation, I think something that isn't talked about a lot and should be is truth about the function of the RCMP, you know? Like, you're well aware that the RCMP is a colonial institution. It was founded to dispossess people of their land, and it continues to fulfill that role. And until we recognize that these institutions are fundamentally racist and need to be dismantled, truth and reconciliation cannot be brought about.
That is so true, because going back to last year, I hold a weekly webinar, and at that time when the George Floyd story broke out, it was Black Lives Matters and all of that, and then it went to the from there to the RCMP to defunding the police. Many issues are surrounding what that what they have turned their institution has turned into today. At that time, we tried to get Brenda Lackey to step down as the police commissioner of Canada. She tried to say at one time that, oh, there's no racism within the RCMP. And even Prime Minister Trudeau corrected her. And she is still there. She is still not, they have not been able to find someone to replace her. And that push of getting her out and getting somebody else in is really, who do we get that is going to listen to both sides or to every side? There has not been an ounce of anything coming from the government, even though they have been pushed by Amnesty International, by all these OHCHR, which is the Human Rights in Geneva, Switzerland, to tell the Canadian government to have the RCMP to stand down off of the Wet'suwet'en Nation and also off the Fairy Creek of the Paciadat Nation. And there has been no call at all, and it has to come from the government. They have to step in once and for all and get the police out of where what they are doing today.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely necessary. It needs to happen. But I question whether the government is fundamentally going to do that, just considering that they haven't really been looking out for the interests of Indigenous people in the past. And I mean, CGL's contract for this pipeline is funded mostly by the government, you know? Trudeau and the Liberal Party in general try to make it seem like they are separate from the issue, or that, I don't know, that they're not involved, but they're actually the ones that are instrumental in pushing these things forward.
Well, what happened there, Olive, is where you have to go to another perspective of, if that doesn't work, there's other avenues of that where we can work from. And what we are doing on the 1st of December, let's say this, for example, at McGill, is we're doing Divest McGill. And that's going to be at the James Administration Building, where I believe that the Prime Minister has an office there. And Divest McGill is where McGill University, for example, they have, they're using their students' endowments funds to invest into with our Royal Bank of Canada, $4.7 million. They are totally not for industry. I have spoken to many banks, and there has been a lot of calls for action on the banks in Victoria, BC. And hundreds of people have stood in front of those banks, let's say the Toronto Dominion, for one, and they rallied in front, and then they stood up in line, over 100 of them, and they marched into the bank one at a time, and it withdrew all their funds. Divesting is like putting it where the monetary system is what we have to get down to the billionaires of all of these big industry. And this is where we've become walking into a brick wall, fighting all this last year with the government, with Truth and Reconciliation, with many other issues that have come up with the Indigenous people. And they know that overriding all of this at the time when Canada Indigenous people are in mourning of the first 215 children that they're trying to bring home, which is now the numbers are over 7,000. They're at a time when they are mourning, and we're talking about truth and reconciliation, and at a time when they're trying to allow the many nations to start dealing with this one church, one group at a time in their own ways. And so you've got so many hats that you're wearing. You're mourning, you got to take off your hat, and then you got to start speaking in solidarity. Again, survival. Then you got to take that off, and then you got to speak and then educate. Educating is very important for us to continue the education of knowing what the Wet'suwet'en, what our lands and title rights are, and where it goes back to many, you know, to the treaty and to the system that we have, and to many things that were fallen through us that were that just fell through the cracks, and to mold and fix each and every issue that is running up against us. Now it's all over again, starting in Ginnamdan as of today, where Molly Wickham, and they're just fighting for the fight of their life to save that river, the Morris River, of having a pipeline put underneath it. Right now in the pipeline in Burnaby is a pure example of how it is all trashed, and now they've got the biggest oil spill. They've got the most toxic lake going through there right now, between dead animals, the oil spill, and all of the other chemicals that are mixed in with it. It is just a biggest environmental mess that's happening in Burnaby, BC right now as we speak. And can you imagine that coming up to the territories and having all the wild game, the wildlife, the salmon, the moose stock, the, you know, drinking out of that. And we use that water ourselves.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you made a really great point about how, you know, the fight for land is the fight for life, and how everyone is a part of that. Everyone's a part of the land. And you mentioned previously about the relationship that, you know, your people have to the land, and since time immemorial, and even in reversal, like the residential schools and violence on Indigenous peoples is directly related to violence on land. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about your relationship to the land, what this means, and just how important it is for everyone living in Canada that a fight against a pipeline is, you know, it benefits everyone living here. So,
well, when you see that the our language of the Wet'suwet'en, we say Skyze, Denise, Zakwaze. Those are the names of chiefs, and that's how we address our. When you say in French here, it's bonjour. There, it's Skyze, Denise, Zakwaze. When we talk about the land, we're talking about the Yinta, and Yin. And the word ta is the land, and how it is all put into of where it was in the past of what it is. We're just trying to keep what was there from so many years. It is pristine. You can just walk up to it and almost drink out of it. It is so pristine. And you cannot do that to many rivers in this world at all. So when you see what our ancestors have lived and how they have taught through my brothers, who was a hereditary chief, and when he is out on the land, for a chief to gain his name, he has to spend a whole month out in the land. And he has to sustain off of it. So he's not to go bring in any groceries or anything out to live out there. He lives out there for 30 days. Then when he comes into the feast house after 30, he's walked in by the other chiefs. Then he's to speak of his experience out there, how he trapped, how he fished, how he did everything on himself, just the way his ancestors have taught him to walk the land, to pick the berries, to understand with the trees, the roots, and the whole system of a tree, where it retains all the water. And my great aunts were basket makers of the trees that grew up there, are the birch trees. They made baskets, and those baskets, today we have so much plastic in our life. At that time, it was all baskets. They made from the bark and the roots. So their thread was the roots. And so you used every part of the animal when you caught it. You were taught that way. You were taught to use every part of a tree when you're to take it down. You use the logs to build your house, your log house. Then you take the bark, you make baskets, and you take the leaves and you make medicine. So when you're taking every part of everything that you have, including all the animals for your winter clothes, and then for the hides are made into moccasins. And so absolutely everything you see today in our culture is from our land. So without the land and the way it was at that time, our culture dies. So for us to revive all of our cultural traditions and ceremonies and everything that we now do in traditional feast houses, and here they call it longhouses, and for us to maintain all of that, we have to have our traditions of what our ancestors have taught us years mm-hmm. before. We continue that education and with through the language. And we, and I do it, I'm a chef activist, and so I do it through food. I teach my students how to speak Skyzate, Denizate, Sakwazate, learning the words of the Wet'suwet'en through food, and learning it, teaching them about the medicine. And we'll make tea, so we'll make bannock, and we'll have tea, all from the land.
Very powerful, you know?
Yeah, so now we'd like to talk a little bit about the solidarity actions that are happening across Turtle Island, not even just across Turtle Island, but also across the world, in terms of standing with Wet'suwet'en and shutting down Canada. So Marlene, could you talk a little bit about all of those actions that are happening, mostly, especially led by youth? And I remember you mentioning about the matriarchal system and how a lot of these actions are also led by matriarchs and women and femmes.
Well, you know, our drum and our voices speak. And when you see the youth today, I call you all my little troublemakers, because they're a good thing. It's all my little troublemakers from McGill University, Concordia, every university here in Montreal. And I have spoken to, and since 2019, March 15th was one of the biggest environmental, I think you were all there when all the schools walked out across the land, and that was the biggest in at Place des Arts, 150,000. In solidarity going back then, I had spoken almost on a daily basis to every event, whether it is minus 30, minus 25, snowing, foot of snow on my head, I was still out there talking. As a matriarch and as a Wet'suwet'en member, just educating the world on what it is like to be in, and thanking everybody, especially the Mohawk Nation where we are today. And I really thank them for being in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en. And so many of the ones that are still walked out and walked through and rallied and shut down railways and the highways and had the rollabouts where they did just drive down the highway and slow down the traffic. It's all done in a peaceful way, is now happening still all across Turtle Island. The 1st of December, for example, we're doing Divest McGill. This Sunday, I will be in Ottawa speaking with students there again, all coming from everywhere, and to crying out with the RCMP what is happening. Today on your show, for instance, the education, the sign of the times is what you're saying. And it is the times of what, that we are not going any more different. And yesterday I was on another Zoom just doing bannock, something peaceful, happily, but still putting the education out there. And whether it's on Zoom or people are out there bearing the cold, the weather back west, I wish them all the best, and hopefully that they all stay safe and dry in the west, considering what this weekend is going to bring to us. As far as the starting tonight and tomorrow, the big clouds are coming back with the heavy rains again. It's going to be almost tenfold of what it was, the same thing that put them there last week in the floods. And so it's not a good time back west. But given through all of that, it's a wake-up call. Of those environmental disasters, has to come from logging. and it has to come from pipelines. And everything that you have destructed, Mother Earth has given us, she is outraged. And they say in the forest, the biggest matriarch we have today is Mother Earth, and she's being destroyed. And we have to live with the destruction of now what she is doing with us. We are not respecting it. And so this is what the call out in the next action is, not just the saying about the RCMP, about CGL, about many other industries that are doing extractions, but it's also the harmful of the environmental, and has now gone to social justice for all of us. It's called survival.
Mm-hmm. And I like what you were saying about this being kind of a wake up call. I hope that we are living through a period of time that is a turning point, especially in this struggle. It seems like the amount of solidarity actions and the content of those actions is becoming increasing in number and becoming increasingly radical. We're seeing so many more blockades of railways and highways. We're seeing actual attacks on infrastructure to shut these things down, to actually disrupt the economic flow of Canada and put pressure on the Canadian government to stop, to actually begin respecting Indigenous sovereignty and protecting the environment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we'd just like to thank you, Marlene, for joining us today. We really appreciate you and all of the things that you're doing, for Wet'suwet'en, for the land, for your family and friends. And we stand with you, and so thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming on the
show. You are so welcome, and Wet'suwet'en would say Tabi Masai. You both have a good day, and thank you again, the Signs of the Times.
The Signs of the Times is a production of CKUT Public Radio. The opinions and views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the station. We thank them very much for providing us with the equipment and resources we need to get the word out.
COVID-19 is quickly circulating throughout the province of Quebec. It's essential that you get tested only if you have COVID-like symptoms. Symptoms such as fever, cough, and loss of taste or loss of smell. As you may already know, testing still remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. For more information, visit quebec.ca/test COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Many years ago, in Montreal city, there was a great emptiness, without any kind of sound, without any kind of harmony, without any kind of voice. Only a hideous monster, the monster of the silence, and his horrible laughing. The Grue Monster had been covered the mouth of every citizen from Montreal with a lot of stronger pieces of masking tape in order to keep quiet any opinion or disagreement. The Black Hand Productions presents The Seven Warriors, the battle for the voice of the voiceless. In 1987, those seven warriors, most of them volunteers, without any kind of payment, found an effective weapon against the monster. They worked for a Ville community radio station, CKUT 90.3 FM, which waves destroyed the monster of the silence. The malefic creature couldn't resist a community radio station with intelligence radio shows, truthful and impartial news, excellent music programming, and the most important,
CKUT is a community radio station that right now is the voice of the voiceless.
The monster died 20 years ago, and today the Montrealers have democratic media communication, which one they can express their opinions in complete freedom, without any piece of masking tape in their mouths.
Nowadays, other seven warriors are taking her CKUT, but without the over of 200 volunteers working, it's impossible to be on air. Do you want to be a volunteer in CKUT? Yes, of course, you want.
Don't forget the battle for the voice of the voiceless, never ending. And remember, a new monster of the silence could be live, and he would like to put a stronger pieces of masking tape in our mouths.
Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
your troubles?
Troubles.
Watch your troubles away.
You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.